So anyway, during my preparation and reading through Lamentations, I had this idea that I thought might be interesting to do that. If you've ever read Lamentations, which it can be a bit of a chore, it's not a cheerful book, but it's searingly honest, and he doesn't mind at all telling God how he feels and expressing himself, and pour out your heart like water before in the presence of the Lord. And I remember I mentioned that phrase that he talks about him being in a mangle, and I thought, you know, we talked a little bit about this, you know, just expressing our thoughts to God. And what I wanted to do is to give you a chance to write a lament. And, you know, we've also talked about a journal, haven't we? As Sanders talked about a journal. So I realize that most of my thoughts like that, I did keep a bit of a journal, but most of my thoughts are just in notes after a Bible study or in a talk. I was just saying with Lizzie that I was just looking over my notes on a talk that I'd given, and I'd noticed how impatient I had been with one of my children, and I remember the incident. And so those little incidents can be interesting to record. And so what I would like to do, that you do it in your form, and in the sense that it's quite appropriate. I'm not trying to kind of make this a terribly introspective, you know, hope that you'll find something wrong to moan about. But our experience is that most people do have things, you know, they may seem small to someone else, but they're not that small to you. And so my suggestion is that you take a little time, just you and the Lord, and maybe you'd like to write some things down about your lament, what you find difficult. I know Sandra and I were sort of thinking, well, you know, some of the younger folks, they may wonder what us older folks are on about. But then in talking with some of the young people, well, they, you know, they have their own pressures. We're just talking about exams, weren't they? The pressure that kids can be under with the exams is tremendous. And so just to take a little time to write your lament. There isn't quite enough time. What I had hoped was that there was less people here, so perhaps some of you can go. But if you don't, the other idea would be that, you know, there's some spaces around. There's a bit of a bench over there, you know, because I thought this is a private thing. You know, I wouldn't want to see Sandra writing her notes how difficult she finds her husband. You know, I might be overlooking that. So I want her to have a little space to actually be free to write down what she wants to write down. And I'll be sitting over there so that we each can have our space. So let's just take a little time to do that. I hope that it's not meant to put you under any pressure. If only good things are happening in your life, then you can write a song of praise. But the idea is just to tune in with our feelings in light of the things that we're finding difficult in our life. Okay? So just take until 4:15 for that. So obviously, you know, there was things in your mind. I could see that you were sort of quite busy thinking and writing. And I think that I wanted, in a sense, to do that so that we could tune in our feelings to sort of what comes next. And if you've still got this with you, this could be a help. Because what I did is I actually put the verses that I want to look at on the piece of paper so that you could follow them along. And just a little word as well about Sandra's. Sandra is not sharing in this session because in some of her thoughts are recorded in what she wrote. I think it's worth just explaining. I put there on purpose 479 because it was in April 1979 when she wrote this, and the circumstances were different. Somebody came up and said, you know, I couldn't quite fit it all in. But this was something, Sandra, as you know, she has these little books that she writes things in, and she wrote this and she showed it to me. And so I said, well, I really think it would be good if people had a chance to see this. And so we put it in our newsletter and subsequently have reproduced it from time to time. So I'm sure some of you have read it, but you may want to have a look at it again. But what we have here in Lamentations is that after this terrible, terrible lament that we've considered the other day, we get this, I know in the writing it doesn't actually stand out, but to me it just like, it stands out. It said, "Yes, this I call to mind, and therefore I have hope." So I kind of feel, in my lament, in your lament, this I call to mind, and therefore I have hope. And I have to say that for me personally, I'm not bringing this to you lightly, that after experiencing and as it were writing my lament, I was not able to straight go into talking about the goodness of God or anything like that. It took me a time to rediscover these truths and find them again for myself. But it has been a terrific journey to kind of back to God, to come on friendly terms, as it were, with Him again. And it's been a good discovery. And so I want to just go through these verses, as it were, one at a time, making a few comments on each one. Verse 22, "Because of the Lord's great love, we are not consumed. His passions never fail." And what this seems to me to be saying is that the first discovery actually that gave him hope was it could have actually been worse. Because of God's love, we were not consumed. We didn't die. And it made me think that I know in my own experience, one time I sat down and I realized that, could somebody close the door, please? That I've had, in fact, 5 escapes from death, as it were, that I was aware of. And my parents love to tell the story about my first escape from death when I was born, and I was so weak, I could hardly even cry because I was born in the hunger winter in Holland. And that's a very sad little story. Bring a tear to your eye. But that was the first time, and I'm not going to give you the sad stories of the other occasions. You've already heard some of those. But I know at the time when these terrible things were happening, there was a feeling of only keeping our head above water. Sandra mentioned that. And I think what's happened as I've sort of been thinking about it and coming back to the truths from God's Word, that at the time, it reminded me of that when I went first on swimming lessons, that after the lessons they finally said, "All right, now you've got to get from there to there." And so we had to swim through this water that was over our head. And I remember the way I got across was I jumped in, I went down, I jumped up, got some air, bit further, jumped up, got some air, went a bit further, finally got to the other side, nearly drowned, but I made it to the other side. And I kind of feel sometimes it was like that for us. I don't even know if it was survival, it was just sometimes under, but coming back up to get enough air to keep going. And I think as I had this picture of ourselves as our nose, Sanders referred to it ourselves, our nose above water. But I think what we realize now is our feet were on a rock. And it began to make sense that if your feet's on a rock, but your nose is here above water, where are your senses? You don't stand there like this and say, "Boy, I'm sure glad I got this rock to stand on." But it's only later that you think, "Yeah, I could have drowned if it wasn't for that rock." And that's what we realize that God was to us. Psalm 40 talks about, "He set my feet upon a rock." And I think that that's not a picture of sort of a lovely hillside with a rock and me standing there. But maybe it's a rock sometimes that's underwater that can't be seen. And it says in this passage that His compassions never fail. He doesn't get tired of feeling for us. That the word compassion in English comes from to suffer with or to feel with. Passion, come, to suffer with. And you know, a phrase has recently come into the vocabulary, isn't it? Charity fatigue. And God doesn't get charity fatigue with us. In fact, it says, "In all our afflictions, He was afflicted. That is the most amazing verse. That's Isaiah 63, verse 9, if you want the reference. In all our afflictions, he feels what you feel. And you remember I mentioned to you how that when I was trying to get a hold of how God feels about our difficulties, I looked at the life of Christ and saw his intense involvement with people. Then the next verse, they are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. And at this new every morning, I to me this conjures up like fresh bread baked every day. It's the same as the day before, but it's new for the day. That's the way it was with the manna for the children of Israel. Every day it was new. And I was seeing this as daily drawing from the resources of his boundless source of involvement with us, of his love, that of God's faithfulness. I was comparing a little bit with human love, and especially romantic love, and maybe not just romantic love, but friendship as well, that, you know, you see a relationship where it starts off and there's real love, but then there is a sense of, well, yeah, this person loves me, but he doesn't really get involved with me. And then after a while, he gets a bit tired of me. He becomes unfaithful. And I thought, well, this is so different with Christ and God. There is love, and it copes with the involvement and the demands of the involvement, and it stays. There was a friend of mine who said about somebody else, he said, I just couldn't cope with her any longer. And I knew what he meant. But the thing is that we're not ever going to be in the situation that God can't cope with us. It's never going to happen. And I think that's what it means when he says he's faithful. He'll continue with us. Then it says in the next verse, I will say to myself, the Lord is my portion, therefore I will wait for him. And the Lord is my portion relates to the situation in Israel where the land was parceled out. And remember, one of the psalmists says, I have received a goodly portion. And it's a word from an agrarian culture. And I come from an agrarian culture. And my father has a piece of land, not a very big piece of land out in the country, that has a wonderful name called the Gibbet. But I don't know how they got that name, but that's what we always refer to it. Only when I sort of translated it in English did I realize what an awful name it was. And I remember, you know, my father's getting older, he needs a hip replacement, he really shouldn't be working. And he said this more than once, he said, you know, this isn't just my hobby, this is my life. And the attachment that a person can form to a land. So when it's saying the Lord is my portion, it's like saying he's my life. He's totally what I'm about. And I like Psalm 73, verse 26. Whom have I in heaven but you? And there is nothing on earth I desire besides you. And so because he's everything, he's worth waiting for. And I was thinking, like, you know how when you get these telephone conversations and, you know, they say, the line is being held, and, you know, so please wait. And then they play you some baroque tune, you know, and you're going insane, and you put the phone down, and you know, you don't want to wait for these people. And you think, this is costing me money. But if you're waiting for a loved one who's valuable to you, it's not a problem, is it? I mean, I'm thinking in that sense of, say, a young lover waiting for the loved one. This isn't true when it's your wife or your husband who's a bit slow, and then your waiting can be very short indeed. So we need to apply that illustration in very specific circumstances. I mean, I don't know about this, but other people...
you get to your playtime.
Yeah. And it says in verse 26, it is good to wait quietly for the salvation of God. And good to wait quietly for the salvation of God. I've come to the conclusion that the waiting is the problem. And God and I have a bit of an unresolved conflict here. I have to tell you that he says he's going to meet my needs. Especially I'm thinking here of my financial needs. And I can't seem to be able to convince him that if he would be a little bit quicker, he would spare me a lot of pain and agony. I wouldn't be so upset. And it would just be a lot easier for me, be a lot easier for my wife, a lot easier for my children, if God would just be a bit quicker with the provision of his needs. And in fact, just here at the conference, I was just looking over and I saw Jonathan. Went up to his dad, sat on his dad's knee, exchanged pleasant greetings with those around us, and said to his dad, "Where's your wallet, Dad?" And Dad, like a good dad, said, "Here's my wallet, son." Well, he didn't actually. He said, "Go and see Claire." And I thought, that's a good dad. That's the way God should be with me all the time. You know, sort of, do you need some cash, Dirk? Here you are. But he's a good dad, and he lets me wait sometimes. And I think that the realization is that one of the things I've been realizing, I think if God delays, he has a bigger agenda. The meeting of your immediate need is actually not the most important thing, though it feels like it to us, of course. And then verse 27, boy, I don't like this verse. It says here, "It is good for a man to bear a yoke while he is young." And I think we just ought to skip that one over. It's sexist, it's ageist, and so we have a problem with that. But in fact, I feel a little bit better than I used to because it says a young man should bear a yoke. I'm an older man, I don't need to bear it. So that's all right for me. But I think, and seriously, that this verse talks about the training factor. And we can't deny it as much as we may like to. And I think when I read it comes to mind, you know, Romans, where it says, suffering produces perseverance or endurance. Endurance produces character. Or the word in the Greek has more to do with proof. And so I begin to like this illustration because it's like a good proof whiskey. Or it has to do with the proof of steel. You know, it's a well-tempered steel. And that well-temperedness, you might say, produces hope. And hope has to do with looking to God and expecting things from him. And it was quite interesting. I read two sort of psychology-type books recently. One called Families and How to Survive Them with John Cleese. And then The Road Less Traveled with Scott Peck. And both of them address this thing, which I found quite interesting. It was the importance of discipline for children. And the way they were phrasing it, it's important for a child that his needs are not immediately met. And they'll never be happy, these psychiatrists were saying, if all their needs are immediately met. And one of the chapter on this is called This is the child speaking, "I'm God, and let's just leave it at that." And it was sort of, it goes on to explain that the child needs to understand that it is not the center of the universe, and that it has to learn to relate in a culture. And it was bringing out, it'll never be happy unless it learns that kind of thing. And I thought, yeah, this is a good illustration of training in the Christian life as well, that it isn't good for us to have our needs met immediately. And as much as, you know, we can shout and scream and have tantrums. And then looking at 28 to 30, it says, "Let him sit alone in silence, for the Lord has laid it on him. Let him bury his face in the dust. There may yet be hope. Let him offer his cheek to one who would strike him, and let him be filled with disgrace." And this seems to me to be saying that we have to submit to life's difficulties. We can't deny, we can't withdraw, we can't refuse. I was thinking it was sort of, this is a bit of a verse like John Wayne, you know, saying to his son, "Take it like a man, son, you know, put up with the difficulties that you have in life." And I realized that there's a real issue here. And I think that the first time I, as a young person, ever came in touch with this, my first time ever in Britain, was during the second time, it was a Billy Graham crusade, and I had a relay into Cambridge, and I stayed with a family there. And there was this lovely widow lady that looked after me, and I really became fond of her. But as I got to know her, I noticed there was kind of like an unpleasant edge to her life, a little crust, a little hardness. And then she told me one day that she said, "You know, when I was very young, I lost my husband. And that was a terrible thing for me. And I said to God, 'No more.'" And she said, "I'm not going to..." She locked away her heart. And she was bitter. And because she wouldn't receive and wouldn't submit to the difficulties that life had to offer, and she didn't receive God's grace. And it was a real sort of challenge to me as a young person to be open to whatever God had to offer, because I could see the alternative of what would happen if we didn't. Then in verse 33, it says, and this is very important, "For he does not willingly bring affliction or grief to the children of men." Now, I want to say something quite clearly here. Is it God's will that we should suffer? No. You see, he doesn't want to hurt any child. Would you? You wouldn't want to hurt even someone you don't like very much. Even if someone you don't like very much gets hurt, you feel sorry for them. And where we know God's will is in the Garden of Eden. That was his original plan. It was, if you read it, it's a wonderful picture of just God providing all kinds of needs. One of the things that always strikes me about the story of the Garden of Eden, he provides fragrances. Maybe you say you need some deodorant, but you don't need all these fragrances. But he gives them to us for our pleasure. We don't need the abundance of creation. We don't need gold. But he wanted to give all those good things to his children. That was his will. But then, as you know, something came in and spoiled his will. And so because of our wills, which were set against his plan, because of the devil's involvement, because of God's judgment on that world, something happened that totally changed the picture. And so it's quite different now. But even now, putting it another way, is it a parent's will to punish a child? Well, I thought, yeah, when I lose my temper, but never mind that. Is it a parent's will to punish a child? No. That you really don't want to do that. I always think of my parents saying to me, you know, this hurts me more than it hurts you. And I used to find that very amusing. Well, not that amusing, actually. But what is God's heart? Jeremiah 31, verse 20 says this. This is a wonderful verse. "Is not Ephraim my dear son, the child in whom I delight? Though I often speak against him, I remember him still. Therefore my heart yearns for him. I have great compassion for him." So even when disciplining, you might say it's against his will to do it. He doesn't want to do it, but he realizes he has to. And that's the same with a loving parent. Then 34 to 36, "To crush underfoot all prisoners in the land, to deny a man his rights before the Most High, to deprive a man of justice, would not the Lord see such things?" And the point here is that do you think, or the point that's trying to say here, do you actually think that God views unfeelingly when a prisoner is crushed, when people are denied their rights, and when justice is not done to the oppressed? This is something that God indeed views with considerable feeling. Then 37 to 39, "Who can speak and have it happen if the Lord has not decreed it? Is it not from the mouth of the Most High that both calamities and good things come? Why should any living man complain when punished for his sins?" And so that what we have here is that God has allowed things to happen in a sense that are not his will. But because of the circumstances and because of the situation we are in, he has allowed both good things and calamities to come. And that's to Christians too. The context of Jeremiah, if he was the writer of this, was that God's judgment was on Jerusalem, and he was a good man, but he lived in Jerusalem. And he not only got it from the punishment that was on Jerusalem, he was also oppressed by the leaders of Jerusalem. And it says this in Psalm 35, verse 19, "A righteous man may have many troubles." And I think it's the Living Bible that translates this, A good man does not escape problems. He has them too. And this is part of the norm. And he could not protect us from all pain unless he took us out of the world. And the only other way he could do it, as far as I can see, is if he ordered all of creation around you. You know, so that here's Dirk and he's walking along, you know, and sort of, oh, there's a stone in the way, you have to move that out of the way. You know, oh, somebody's going to hurt his feelings, knock them out of the way. You know, it just wouldn't be possible. Well, it would be possible, and maybe not a bad idea if I was the only person on earth, but I'm not. And I was alerted to this by a comment of Eric Liddell's in the film Chariots of Fire. Whether he said it or not, I don't know, but he said, the Almighty does not order his day around me. And so it would rather be nice. I can't deny that it would be rather nice, but he doesn't. You know, I always, you know how I often realize that when we read the Bible, we always, and when we live, we also always kind of think God's on our side, isn't he? But he's not on our side. He's on everybody's side. We're his favorite, but everybody's his favorite. And this is why we do have this both calamities and good things come. And then looking at 40 to 41, it says, let us examine our ways and test them, and let us return to the Lord. Let us lift up our hearts and our hands to heaven and say. And so Lamentations really starts off with examining God's ways and what we may find difficult, but it realizes that it comes around that rather than us examining God and questioning God, we need to look at ourselves. And that I was thinking of Job. Job has a similar experience that he kind of offers a big complaint, really, about the circumstances that he's in. And even though he was true in the sense that he wasn't judged because of anything that he had done wrong, but he was so busy justifying himself that he was quite prepared to put God in the wrong. And then God comes out of the situation, and then Job actually does repent because he said, I've seen you and I've heard from you, and it looks very different now. And I think this is the same feeling that I get from Jeremiah, because he actually turns to repentance after his response to all these things that he's focused on God. And as you read the rest of the chapter, you see it's a mixture of repentance and worship. In a sense, that is really what we're going into now, that we have the opportunity for worship. And we've had a little trouble with the time, and so we might not have quite as much time as we had originally planned, but we want to spend the rest of the time in worship.